All right, we're going to crank back up here. And a couple things on the break, you know, brought bunny trails back around. I love those bunny trails Charlie talks about. One of them was, we were talking about the Bible outside. And when they didn't have the big book written yet, you will see pictures of the old-timers when they were leading meetings, they were using the Bible. Because they were coming from the Oxford group before they wrote the big book, they were using the Bible. And if you ever get a chance to visit Dr. Bob's house, it's called A House Full of Miracles, up in Akron, there's a glass case in the living room where the Bible is opened up to the page that says, faith without works is dead. And so, yes, the Bible plays into this book, but more than that, I truly believe that the hand of God came down and just got into Bill's soul, got into his spirit, and got into all the rest of them who got sober and stayed sober. And they stayed sober because they did things like what we're doing right now. We're studying.
Hi. Question, if that's okay.
Yeah.
And say, just save it until we get to the chapter we need agnostic, okay?
Okay.
If you want to, and that's fine with me.
Right.
Because I can, and I agree with you how fervent you are about having God in your life and how important he was mm-hmm. coming into Bill's and Dr. Bob's soul and mind mm-hmm. and everything else to be a part of this mm-hmm. book. Do you have to, I haven't experienced a sponsee yet that's agnostic or atheist. Do you have a problem with that?
Do I have a problem with it? Not at all.
Because I'm just listening to you so far about that.
Not at all, because I know today that absolutely in my life, there is a God.
Yeah.
There is a God, and it'll tell you in the book that we should keep that God personal. Now, if people want to blurt out their God's Buddha or Allah or Jesus, I don't have a problem.
Because I knew an Indian guy in the program that was just an amazing speaker because he talked about the God of the wind. And
yeah, absolutely. And absolutely. There are some great speakers who are American Indians mm-hmm. that use the Great Spirit.
Yeah.
And we'll talk about it.
Okay.
What it is you can't do it on your own.
Right.
And we'll learn that even no human power could relieve us of that obsession. That it has to come from a power greater than ourselves, and that's in chapter 6 agnostic, and we'll get to that.
All right, so
I'm on XIII, which is forward to the first edition, and it says we. Now, right there, we is those first 100 that wrote this book. They're sharing with us what happened to them. So it says, we of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women who have recovered, there's that word, recovered again, okay, from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body to show other alcoholics, all right, to show other alcoholics, not to tell other alcoholics, to show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. Okay, so this book has one main purpose. It's to show other alcoholics how this first 100 recovered from a hopeless state of mind and body. And I'm going to say it right now so I don't forget about it later on. Recovered, if you'll look it up, simply means to get well. Okay? The book will tell us later on that we are never cured of alcoholism. That what we have is a daily reprieve based on our spiritual condition. And that's later on in the book. But recovered simply means to get well. Now, I'm sick coming into Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know it until I put the drink down and I start working the program and I learn that I've been sick for 30 years. And so I want to get well. So I want to get recovered. But I'm never going to be cured. And a lot of people in a lot of rooms get the hair up on the back of the neck when somebody introduces themselves as a recovered alcoholic. I'm a recovered alcoholic. I got well. I am not in a hopeless state of mind and body anymore. I am an alcoholic. I will always have alcoholism. I will never be cured. Okay? I have a program that I don't have to drink and I don't have to hurt anybody. And that's what the main purpose is of this book. Precisely how they recovered. For them, we hope these pages prove so convincing that no further altercation would be necessary. We think this account of our experience will help everyone to better understand the alcoholic. Many do not comprehend that the alcoholic is a very sick person. Now, I'd highlight the alcoholic is a very sick person. And besides, we're sure that our way of living has its advantages for all. And the advantages for all were non-alcoholic wives, before Al-Anon ever came around, non-alcoholic wives, non-alcoholic husbands of alcoholic wives could get this book sent to them, read it, and understand better what they were dealing with. You know, I'm dealing with this drunk. Well, right there it tells me you're dealing with a sick person. And not just a sick person. An alcoholic is a very sick person. Okay, and I think we'll all agree with that. And at the time, it says it is important that we remain anonymous because we're too few at present to handle the overwhelming number of personal appeals which may result from this publication. And that's what they were hoping, is that they'd publish this book and that they would be overwhelmed. Well, I can tell you from history's sake, they sent out this book to every medical doctor in the United States with a card in there saying, please send this card back with how many orders you want. And they waited. They waited, you know, they're on pins and needles for like 3 or 4 days before they went down to their post office box, which is called Box 453, which is something GSO puts out right now. And they were just thinking it was going to be filled with envelopes. And they had like 10 cards. And 8 of the cards back from the doctor were written in drunken handwriting. And 2 of them were, are you out of your mind? Who do you think you are? And so there was an extreme disappointment when they first pushed this book. This book took a while to catch on. And I'll tell you how it caught on in a couple minutes. Being mostly business or professional folks, we could not well carry on our occupations in such an event. If they had to handle all the personal appeals that they were thinking were coming, they couldn't keep doing their jobs. We would like it understood that our alcoholic work is an avocation. So an avocation is not a vocation. A vocation is a job. An avocation is something you do in addition to your regular work. Okay? And we'll learn more about how we live this program, not just work it and then stop. When writing or speaking publicly about alcoholism, we urge each of our fellowship to omit his personal name, designating himself instead as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. So that right there, in the very first foreword, they're trying to stay anonymous. They're trying to keep it a secret society. And, you know, the only way you're going to learn about it is word of mouth, until we get some press, and we don't get press for a little while. And they also asked the press to observe the request, for otherwise we shall be greatly handicapped.
Somewhere in there, it might be the 12 and 12. You want me to raise my hand and keep my mouth shut, or something comes up trying to discuss
it? Well, keep your mouth shut. All right. But go ahead, and 12 and 12 what? Because I will reference that.
This is one of the few times that the press really honored a request of this, and at the same time, though, helped them a great way.
But that was after the 12 and 12 got written.
Okay.
And that's 13 years later. Yeah. And I'll tell you, the biggest violator of the anonymity was Bill Wilson. GSO has 2 portfolios, one in 1942 and 1943, and they're from a clipping service that went to every newspaper in the United States and clipped out everything that Bill Wilson was on the front page of a paper talking about. Bill Wilson's magic cure, Bill Wilson's 12-step, Bill Wilson this. And he was the one that realized that he was violating the tradition that should be in place. And that's why when he wrote those traditions, he never spoke publicly again, as far as in front of non-alcoholics. He never gave his last name. And the reason I give my last name when I speak at an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting is because what Dr. Bob said in Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers. It's a direct violation of the anonymity clause to not give your last name in an AA meeting as it is to give it in the press, radio, public. He felt, and I agree, that if I'm in an AA meeting, that you need to know who I am. You need to know how to find me. And really the situation came about because somebody came down from Cleveland because they heard that there was a Dr. Bob in trouble in Akron, and they were trying to find Dr. Bob to do a 12-step call on him, and it was Bob Smith. It was Dr. Bob. And he realized that, you know, if you're in an AA meeting, there's nothing wrong with using your last name. He encouraged it. If you're out in the public, it is not encouraged. Okay? And so when I speak, and I do this down in Florida, and I've been blessed to be asked to do that, but I've been involved with the Public Information Committee. I've been involved in jails and institutions. If I go talk before a group of, say, judges or something like that, my name's Jim P. I do not break it. And if I talk before a group of alcoholics where it's a large group, say at a state convention or something like that, I will say something like, my name is Jim Powers, I'm a recovered alcoholic, and if there's anybody here from the press, radio, or film, I'd appreciate it if you respect our tradition of anonymity and do not publish my last name at all. Now, this recently happened over in Albany, where two treatment centers got together to honor a man who had 32 years of sobriety, and they put it on the front page of the Albany Herald that this man has saved millions of lives through carrying the message of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it violated about four different traditions. Now, the man was only quoted once, but they used his full name, they used his picture, but when he was quoted at the very end of the article, he said, I don't keep anybody sober, it's all God. And that was the only quote from him. But these other people, the treatment centers, just violated the traditions all to hell by doing it. It's very nice to give the man a plaque, don't get me wrong, but to put it on the front page of a newspaper, they just threw, you know, the 12th tradition into the wind. And I don't believe they should have done that, but I don't get to say anything about it. On the end of this forward, it says, there are no fees or dues whatsoever. The only requirement, now, there's going to be requirements in this book. You know, it's a suggested program. My sponsor says it's suggested that you don't drink and do what it says in the book. And there's going to be a couple requirements. You've heard people say there's no must in Alcoholics Anonymous. There's going to be like 77 musts in this book. And there's even going to be a demand. Okay? There's going to be a demand of me and of you. The only requirement for membership is an honest desire to stop drinking. Now, they dropped that when they did the 12 traditions. They dropped the word honest. Okay? Why would you think they dropped the word honest? How many alcoholics coming into Alcoholics Anonymous or reading this book for the first time are going to be honest? Yeah. None. Yeah. None. We don't know anything about honesty when we get here. We're drunks. Okay? So, we're not allied with any particular faith, sect, or denomination, nor do we oppose anyone. We simply wish to be helpful to those who are afflicted. And they shall be interested to hear from those who are getting results from this book, particularly from those who have commenced work with other alcoholics, which is the whole goal of this book, is to get me sober, to keep me sober, to get me living a life beyond my wildest dreams, but to carry the message to somebody else. Because when I stop carrying the message, I've stopped practicing Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've started practicing Jim's recovery program. And Jim's recovery program, I'll tell you later on, will get you drunk if you follow Jim's recovery program. All right? All right, forward to the second edition. It's gonna talk about how they jumped right there, our earliest printing, voiced the hope that every alcoholic journeys will find the fellowship of the Alcoholics Anonymous at his destination. Already continues the early texts, twos and threes and fives have sprung up in other communities. People were going from Akron, from New York, and from Cleveland. They were carrying the book around with them. And so they were starting little groups of twos and threes in different communities all over. And what they're hoping is that they find the fellowship but the fellowship won't keep you sober. You know, there is fellowship recovery, and there's the AA program of recovery, and there are two different things. The program of recovery is what gets me sober, keeps me sober, and keeps me doing what I'm doing. The fellowship is a byproduct. But without the fellowship, I would have never gotten here. I would never have gotten a chance to get sober. Okay, so the fellowship is very important, and that's the unity on the triangle. You know, the fellowship is extremely important, but I can't stay sober on just not drinking and going to meetings. I'll kill myself if I don't drink and go to meetings and don't do anything else. And it happens to a lot of people. It talks about in 1955 when the second edition was printed that Alcoholics Anonymous had nearly 6,000 groups whose members had far above 150,000 recovered alcoholics. Okay, there's the fourth time it's been used. And then there were groups going all over the United States. They went to Canada, and then it started going all over the world. I'm thinking right now, and if I have my most recent statistics right, that there are about 165,000 Alcoholics Anonymous groups worldwide, and there are a little over 2 million members in recovery or recovered in Alcoholics Anonymous active right now worldwide. Now, this book has got to be something, if that's where it all started from. I mean, it's got to be something. So in the 16 years, you know, between the first and the second, it had jumped to that many. And the same book is now available in 2013, and there's millions. The first, down at the bottom of the page, the spark that was to flare into the first AA group was struck in Akron, when the stockbroker, which really was the stock speculator, Bill Wilson, and an Akron physician, Dr. Bob, had a talk. And it says, 6 months earlier, the broker had been relieved of his drink obsession by a sudden spiritual experience following the meeting with an alcoholic friend who had been in contact with the Oxford group that day. He had also been greatly helped by the late Dr. William D. Silkworth, a New York specialist in alcoholism, and he's now accounted no less as a medical saint by AA members, and whose story of the early days of our society appears in the next pages. From this doctor, the broker had learned the grave nature of alcoholism. All right, that's step one. The grave nature. The reason I like doing the history is, and I think I might have said it, is that if we don't learn from history, we're doomed to repeat it, right? If we don't learn from history, we're doomed to repeat it. That word doomed is not a good word for me. You know, if I don't learn from Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm doomed to repeat what I did when I got in here, which was just keep going in and out, in and out. Though he could not accept all the tenets of the Oxford group, he was convinced of the need for a moral inventory, confession of personal defects, restitution of those he harmed, helpfulness to others, and the necessity of belief in and dependence upon God. And they're talking about Bill here. Prior to his journey to Akron, the broker had worked hard with many alcoholics on the theory that only an alcoholic could help an alcoholic, but he had succeeded with only keeping himself sober. He'd gone to Akron on a business venture. We talked about that. It collapsed. And he suddenly realized that in order to save himself, he must carry the message to other alcoholics. There's the must right there. There's the first must. And when the broker gave Dr. Silkworth's description of alcoholism and his hopelessness, the physician began to pursue the spiritual remedy for his malady with the willingness he had never before been able to muster. Now, when Bill explained to Bob the spiritual malady, and we have a twofold disease. It's of the body and it's of the mind. Okay? Now, later on, we're going to find out that we're going to have to get over our spirituality before we get over our obsession or our compulsion and the physical allergy that comes from taking that first drink. So, He knew that he had to pursue the spiritual remedy. And so, this right here, the physician had repeatedly tried spiritual means to resolve his alcoholic dilemma, but had failed. And once he had pursued the spiritual remedy for this malady with a willingness he had never before been able to muster, he sobered, never to drink again to the moment of his death in 1950. It's 15 years later. This seemed to prove that one alcoholic could affect another as no alcoholic could. It also indicated the strenuous work, there's a word to underline right there, strenuous work, one alcoholic with another was vital to permanent recovery. All right, stop right there. Strenuous work is not just, you know, call me every couple days, you know. It was in your face, we're doing these steps, and then you're carrying this message. Dr. Bob had a way of working the 12 steps within a day or 2 days with new people. Now, when they were originally working with these people, the people that would come to them and say, I can't stop drinking, you've got a cure, you've got an answer, I need to go somewhere, I need your help. And Bob had a philosophy that the best way to help an alcoholic first was get him away from liquor. So they started getting some rooms at the local hospital in Akron. Sister Ignatia was a big part of this, and I'll talk more about her later on, because she got the first actual room for an alcoholic. Alcoholics weren't allowed to go to hospitals back then. They went to sanitariums. Hospitals didn't have room and didn't have anything to do. They couldn't fix an alcoholic. All they could do is tie him down and let him. So what Bob did was he would take him into the hospital. You were fed for 7 days. Caro syrup, tomatoes, and sauerkraut. That was your meal for 7 days while you detoxed. Caro syrup was for sugar and the craving for sweets. The sauerkraut was nutritious. I still haven't figured out what the tomatoes and tomato paste was for, but that was your meal. Now, how many of y'all would voluntarily check into a detox and say, feed me that for the next 7 days? I don't think anybody would.
Tomato has 300% more vitamin C than an orange. Mm-hmm. It probably was for the antioxidant.
Yeah. It was also, there's a theory that the only thing that Bill could hold down whenever he went to the hospital was Caro syrup and sauerkraut and tomatoes. And so that's, he had an ulcer, and that was the only thing that wouldn't affect his ulcer. And so here we are in the very beginning, we're working with whatever we got. Whatever seems to be working, we're trying it. Okay? You know, Bob had, in the 2.5 years that he was going to the Oxford group, he had gone to drying out farms 6 different times. And he did hydrotherapy, he did all this other stuff, and couldn't stay sober, you know, other than when he was locked up. Alright, next paragraph. Hence the 2 men to work almost frantically upon alcoholics arriving in the ward of the Akron City Hospital. Their very first case, a desperate one, recovered immediately. Now that right now is the 5th time the word recovered has been used, and we haven't even got to page 1. And became AA number 3. That's Bill Dotson, the man on the bed, and he never had another drink. They continued working at the hospital. A second group started up in New York, like I said, after that in 1937, with the third one in Cleveland. And then there were other alcoholics, like I said, that would grab the book, go from one of these Oxford group meetings and move somewhere, and then would form a group there. And at the end of that sentence, it says, by late 1937, the number of members having sustained sobriety time behind them, substantial sobriety time behind them, was sufficient to convince the membership that a new light had entered the dark world of the alcoholic. All right? Okay, and it talks about how we got our name. The membership had reached about 100 men and women by 1939. The fledgling society, which had been nameless up to then, now began to be called Alcoholics Anonymous from the title of its own book. Now, it's either the title of its own book, which they decided on themselves, but the Cleveland group had already started using the name Alcoholics Anonymous prior to the book being published. So I think Clarence thought the book was named after his group. Let's see where I'm at with time. Okay. All right, let's see. Okay. This is where we're going to start getting some of our influx of people. In the next page, XVIII, in the fall of 1939, when the book's been published, Fulton Ulster, then editor of the Liberty, printed a piece in the magazine called Alcoholics and God. And this brought a rush of 800 frantic inquiries into the little New York office, which meanwhile had been established. Each inquiry was painstakingly answered. Pamphlets and books were sent out. Businessmen traveling out of existing groups referred to these prospective newcomers, and new groups started up. Bill, for the first number of years, answered every letter that was written to New York. And finally, Bill and Ruth were answering every letter before they started hiring people. In the spring of 1940, John D. Rockefeller gave a dinner for many of his friends, to which he invited AA members to tell their stories. News of this got on the world wires, inquiries poured in again, and many people went to the bookstores to get the book Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, when John Rockefeller gave that dinner, Bill Wilson thought he was going to be a millionaire. Now, Rockefeller was one of the richest men in the world. He invited like 400 of the richest men in the world to come to this dinner to hear about this great thing. He had sent a man out to Akron to investigate this group of people calling themselves Alcoholics Anonymous, and he thought it was the greatest thing. And so he was going to put this dinner on, and Bill thought, you know, I'm going to collect $1 million, $2 million from book sales, and I'm going to get rich. And what Rockefeller told him was, money will ruin this thing, Bill. You've got a great thing, but if you mix money and spirituality, it'll ruin it. And Bill's heart dropped, because Bill wasn't making any money. Lois was working at a department store. And Rockefeller gave Bob and Bill like $25 a week stipend, which was a lot of money back then, and the book started to sell. Rockefeller also gave a copy of every one of the book to every one of the people there. All 400 people got a copy of the book. And so those people started passing it around, and, you know, I'm sure there were quite a few drunks with a lot of money there that started seeing they had a way out too. In 1941, right before 41, 1940 I think, the Cleveland Plains Dealer did a three-part article on Clarence Snyder's group called Alcoholics Anonymous in Cleveland. And it brought in about 8,000 members to that group. And they had to form some separate groups. But it was, Clarence kind of manipulated the newspaper, and like Bill was manipulating the newspaper. And what happened was, Jack Alexander was a real famous writer for the Saturday Evening Post. And he wrote an article that was so compelling that, and so well received, that 8,000 members joined by the end of 1941. Now, when Jack Alexander went to write that piece, he didn't go to write a glowing recommendation. He went to kill and trash Alcoholics Anonymous. He had just written an expose on the longshoremen up in Jersey and New York working for the mafia. And he'd gotten a lot of publicity for writing that expose on these longshoremen and all the crookedness behind it. And he thought that Alcoholics Anonymous was a scam, and he was going to expose it. And he met with Bill, and Bill and Bob said, if you would go to just a certain number of meetings, it's either between 10 and 20, and don't tell them who you are, go to different groups, listen to different people, hear the story, and then if you want to write an article, write it any way you want. And what he found by going to those 10 or 20 meetings was there was a program that was working, and people were getting and staying sober by following the simple directions. And so he wrote this very glowing article, and thousands of people started wanting the book Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I feel privileged to be sitting in the Eufaula group of Alcoholics Anonymous, because this group got started because of Jack Alexander's article. The lady who sponsors is a woman named Margaret, who we all know, who will be celebrating 45 years this month. Her sponsor was the one that started the Eufaula group, and she read the Jack Alexander article and got on the bus and went to the nearest AA location, and at the time it was in Montgomery, Alabama. Now, back in 1945 or 6, whenever this started, that was a hike on a bus. And when she got up there, this woman was committed to the mental institution in Prattville, just a little bit north of Montgomery. And every day, two alcoholics would come and talk to her. And after 7 days of being there and going through the alcoholic regime, she got out. She went to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings with them for a while there, stayed up in Montgomery, and then came back and started the Eufaula group of Alcoholics Anonymous. And so the history behind this group goes all the way back to the Jack Alexander article, which is a trip for me to be sitting here today doing this here, because I am really a history buff. Alright, now we got a bunch of people. And it says at the bottom of that page, our society then entered a fearsome and exciting adolescent period. The test that it faced was this. Could these large number of erstwhile erratic alcoholics successfully meet and work together? Would there be quarrels over membership, leadership, and money? Would there be strivings for power and prestige? Hell yes. We're alcoholics. I mean, do we not have egos even, you know? Bill talks about ego deflation and death later on. But what we found on the next page, on the first paragraph, that says, but out of all this frightening and at first disrupting experience, the conviction grew that AAs had to hang together or die separately. We had to unify our fellowship or pass off the scene. Okay? It was thought that no, next paragraph down about 4 or 5 lines, it was thought that no alcoholic man or woman could be excluded from our society, that our leaders must serve but never govern, that each group was to be autonomous, but there was to be no professional class of therapy. There would be no fees or dues. Our expenses were to be met by our own alcoholic, own voluntary contributions. That's why when we have an open speaker meeting here on Saturday night, and Mac chairs the meeting, he always says, if you're here at an open speaker meeting and you're not an alcoholic, please do not put any money in the basket. It is from our own voluntary contributions that our expenses are met. And AA is self-correcting. If there's not enough money to keep an AA group going, the AA group will fold. Happens all the time. Happening currently over in my county in Georgia. There's been a meeting there for about 30-something years, and that meeting is closing because there's not any participation anymore. And you can't drag people in there. They have to come on their own. And it's sad to see, but I've been blessed to start meetings, and this will be the first one that I actually say that I'm going to help them dispose of their property in the proper way, because it has to go. It can't be an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting when two Al-Anon women are paying the bills. It just can't. And what you're reading, what we're reading right here is a whole bunch of what the traditions are saying. Our public relations were to be based on attraction rather than promotion. Bill realized that him going around getting all that public relations exposure was not good for Alcoholics Anonymous, because if he could do it, why couldn't somebody else do it? And then what happens when that person got out in public and was drunk? You know, people would think Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't work. You know, just like all these people you see in magazines like National Enquirer and things like that, you know, they go to AA and then they talk about, I'm clean and sober because I've been in AA, and then 2 weeks later, you know, the paparazzi's got pictures of them smoking coke with a beer in one hand. You know, that does not do anything good for us to have them running around publicly saying, you know, they could say they went to a 12-step program, that's fine. But when they've dragged the name Alcoholics Anonymous into the press, that's a direct violation, and that is the reason why, is we did not want people to be out there on press, radio, TV, films. And in no circumstance should we give our endorsements or make alliances or enter into public controversies. They wanted to make sure that they did not associate with any certain facility, because they were starting to do that in the early 40s. There were going to be AA hospitals in certain towns, Middleburg, America. They wanted to have an AA hospital on one floor, a clubhouse on the second floor, a beginner's meeting on the third floor, and a detox on the fourth floor. And they were going to charge people to come in. And the whole thing fell apart. And the guy realized he was trying to be grandiose about the whole thing. And that's a tradition seminar that I give, so I'm not going to get into that. Well, we just read that paragraph right there. It goes on to say, this was the substance of AA's 12 traditions, which is now stated in full on page 561 of this book. And though none of these principles had the force of rules or laws, they had become so widely acceptable by 1950 that they were confirmed by our first international conference held at Cleveland. And some people don't know it. Bill was writing these traditions and putting them in the grapevine. And there's a bunch of grapevines on the table there. Meeting in print, and that's what they were mailing out to people that were wanting to get updates and things like that. And so Bill each month would be, or each, not every month, but on a continuous basis, he was writing article after article after article and publishing it. And he was publishing these different traditions. And all the way up to 1950, he was trying to get Dr. Bob to agree. And Bob was just, I just don't think we need those. I just don't think we need those. And before he died in 1950, Bob told Bill, we need those. Go ahead and publish them. And so the 12 and 12 was published a couple of years after Dr. Bob died. It did replace a book that I have and I carry with me, and that Dr. Bob used. It was called the Little Red Book. And that was what was kind of like what the 12 and 12 is. It gave a different, a little bit larger explanation to the steps, if you just read them on the board there. But it also helped learn a little bit more out of the big book. Helped me learn a little bit more. Alright, I don't want to run out of time. But I do want, okay, we're going to go to the next page, XX. Because I do think, a lot of people say, oh, I don't care about statistics. Well, I do. AA grew by leaps and bounds and for the two principal reasons. Large number of recoveries and reunited homes. This made their impressions everywhere. Of the alcoholics who came to AA and really tried, you want to underline that or highlight, really tried, 50% got sober at once and remained that way, and 25% sobered up after some relapses, and among the remainder of those who stayed on in AA showed improvement. So here we got 50% get recovered because they really try. 25% try and finally get recovered. So that's 75% right there. That's pretty good statistics. And that program is, this is the same program today, but the last GSO survey that went out, it was in 2009. And there's so many groups that they just have to, it's almost like a random pick. We're going to send this to the central random group, and we're going to ask them to fill out the survey, and the group conscience gets together and fills out the best they can, you know. And they do that to large groups, they do it to small groups. I'm sure you follows filled one out before. But the last one they did was in 2009, when they asked how many people had stayed sober for longer than a year. I want to know what it is. 8%. 8%. What happened? Well, in, I think it's Dr. Bob. I'm not sure if it's Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers or someplace else. They said that outside influences were starting. They were saying that people were coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, they were getting a taste of spirituality, they went back to church, and they couldn't stay sober. They were going to treatment centers and coming out of treatment centers, and they were coming out with non-alcoholic counselors telling them things, group hug, group therapy, all this other stuff, and it's just gotten watered down. And that's why I really love doing a big book study, because I'm only going to be reading from what these guys read. I'm not going to be reading from any outside books. And there's thousands of them out there. And the book also tells me later on to see where religious people are right and use what they use. And I do. You know, if I don't go to church every Sunday, do I think I'm going to hell? No. My God's a loving God, but it's a personal God. So from the beginning, when people came in desperate, the definitive comment in that whole thing is really tried. They really tried. I mean, it was vital. A minute ago, I skipped over the word vital, but it was vital to their life. It was life or death to them to get recovered. And so that's what happened. Now we have all these other therapies, and I think there's something like 250 12-step programs right now that are based on the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I didn't believe it when my friend Charlie Parker talked about it. He thinks there's a lip balm anonymous program out there. And then I went to a meeting about a week later, and I saw some lady there. She had this lip balm, and she was putting it on about every 5 seconds. And I'm like, I think there's a program for that woman somewhere. I don't know where, but I bet you there's a program for doing that. He goes on to say down at the end, because I'm running out of time, I know, Alcoholics Anonymous is not a religious organization. Neither does AA take any particular medical point of view, though we cooperate widely with the men of medicine as well as the men of religion. We cooperate. And it talks about the membership right then was pyramiding at about 20% a year. So several million actual and potential alcoholics have made only a scratch. In all probability, we shall never be able to touch more than a fair fraction of the alcohol problem in all its ramifications. Upon therapy for the alcoholic himself, we surely have no monopoly. And that's what they're wanting you to know. They don't have the answer to everything. Yet, it is our great hope that all of those who have yet found no answer may begin to find one in the pages of this book and will presently join us on the high road to new freedom. All right, that's to the second edition. I'm going to go over the third edition real quick. It's talking about, you know, they got more than a million people in 28,000 groups, 90 countries. By then, I think there was 20,000 editions of the big book printed. I know when I went to the San Antonio International Convention in 2010, they gave the 30 millionth edition to the American Medical Society. The first printing of the 30 millionth printing of Alcoholics Anonymous. So this book has been printed, you know, it's one of the largest selling, if not the best selling book in the world. You know, maybe the Bible's the only one that sells more, I'm not sure. And I should be sure of something, huh? It's gone into, you know, it's been translated into all these different languages, and I'll go back into some of the, who translated it where at another meeting. But the biggest thing is at the bottom of the third edition, and I use this when I talk, it's, in spite of the great increase in the size and the span of this fellowship, at its core, it remains simple and personal. And I like the rest of this. Each day, somewhere in the world, recovery begins when one alcoholic talks with another alcoholic, sharing experience, strength, and hope. Every day, somewhere in the world, recovery begins. All right, I got about 5 minutes left. The forward to the fourth edition, now we're talking about over 100,000 groups meeting in 150 countries. We're growing, and that's 2001 when this book came out, the fourth edition. And it wound up being the second book I bought because the first book was given to me, was the third edition, and I didn't stay sober on the third edition until the fourth edition it got printed, because 2002 is when my sobriety date is, and this came out in 2001. But I use the third edition. It's just the book I like to read. The one I mark up and work with my guys with is the fourth edition, because that's the one most everybody gets now. In country after country, I'm just going to skip around a couple places. In country after country where the AA seed was planted, it has taken root, slowly at first, then growing by leaps and bounds when literature has become available. Currently, Alcoholics Anonymous has been translated into 43 languages. That's in 2001. I think it now is in 60 or 65 different languages. There are places where you just would not believe Alcoholics Anonymous meet. One of them is China. Right? One of them is Iran.
North Korea.
Those places, Alcoholics Anonymous is still really a secret society because they are being watched. And so they have a meeting where the watchers are, and then they have another meeting underground where they can talk about the God of their understanding without fear of being taken off and hauled off. It's getting accepted a little bit more, but there are certain countries that are still really against us. As the message of recovery has reached larger numbers of people, it's also touched the lives of vastly greater variety of suffering alcoholics. When the phrase, "we are people who normally would not mix," that's on page 17, was written in 1939, it referred to a fellowship composed largely of men and a few women who were quite similar social, ethnic, and economic backgrounds. Like so many of AA's basic texts, those words have proved to be far more visionary than the founding members could ever have imagined. We are people who not normally mix. I'm looking around this room, and I'm saying to myself, I doubt that I would have hung out with any of you. I'm sorry. I know that none of you would have wanted to hang out with me. You know, I was a pretty bad, troublesome drunk, and so we probably weren't going to hang out together. But we get along great in the room, and we get along great doing the deal together. And at the end of that forward, because I'm going to start the doctor's opinion next week. Any meeting anywhere, AA shares experience, strength, and hope with each other in order to stay sober and help other alcoholics. Modem to modem or face to face, AA speaks the language of the heart in all its power and simplicity. Now, I agree with that. There are big book studies on Skype. There are big book meetings. Most of you know that my sponsor has a website that now has over 25,000 speakers on it that are available for free. That's what he has done to give back to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. He is currently finishing doing about 400 cassettes that Margaret from this group gave us from her husband and her collection. And out of that set that we got from Margaret, he only had about 20 on his website already. And so all these other ones that we were given to put on the website, we never had before. And I can tell you, this man, he's 28 years sober. He's a little Scotsman, but he has nothing but a thirst for sharing this book, this work of recovery. One last historical tidbit. Judy, you're the only woman in here tonight.
I can be excused.
You are not excused. You are welcome. But in 1940, when the first woman came to Akron, she was not allowed in. Dr. Bob was panicked of what you all would do to our society.
What?
Yeah. How? Women can't be alcoholics back in the early 40s, late 30s. They weren't alcoholics. They were ladies.
Oh,
they drank too much. They drank too much. But he was worried about two things. One, women coming in and distracting the men trying to get sober. Cutie. And two, the men who were getting sober's wives. What would they think about women coming in? And so the first sponsors of the first women were the wives, Lois and Ann Wilson. Lois Wilson and Ann Smith were sponsoring the first women coming in. Okay? The first woman that came into the meeting in New York was a man. Her name was Marty Mann. And she came into the meeting right when they weren't letting women in, and she wasn't leaving. And if you ever seen a picture of Marty Mann, I wasn't going to be the one to ask her to leave the meeting either. But she got sober, working the program. Bill was her sponsor, I think. And for the next 18 months, every woman who came into the New York group, Marty Mann sponsored. Eventually, they started letting everybody in. Because in the book, in the 12 of 12, it talks about they were so afraid of letting other people in that, you know, the guy who came to the meeting and said, you know, I'm an alcoholic and I need help, but I have another handicap. A lot of people want to say it's a black man in a wig who's a hooker and a transvestite shooting heroin. Chet Parker, or Chet P, tells me, if you weren't there, you don't know. I do know that blacks had to start their own meeting in Cleveland because of segregation when they first came in. I do know that in 1941, the first killing of a man picking up a woman to take her to a meeting happened in Cleveland. This woman's husband did not know that she was going to Alcoholics Anonymous, and he would go to work and she would go to a meeting. And she didn't go out, women didn't go out at night by themselves, and so there's nothing going on, a man just coming by to escort her to a meeting so she could get recovery. The husband found out about it from a neighbor, he hid in the bushes, he killed the guy. So there was a little consternation with Dr. Bob letting women come in, letting blacks come in, letting other people come in, and finally, and Bill admitted this in a book called AA Comes of Age, when he turned over the reins in 1955 to World Services, he admitted that when they sat down and said, you know, what are we so afraid of? You know, we're afraid that our pure alcoholics are going to be ruined by these other people. And five words came out of Dr. Bob's mouth. What would the master do? And that solved the issue of who are we going to let in, who are we not going to let in. We're going to let anybody in, no matter who they are, no matter what they are. If they're an alcoholic and they're seeking recovery, we're going to let them in. All right, that is the history and the forwards. Next week we're going to start on the doctor's opinion, and we'll get a little bit into Bill's story. If you can make it next week, that would be great. I'm going to do these things in a row. Each week I'm going to refer back to something that I talked about the week before. And when I do that, you weren't here the week before, you're going to look at me like I got four eyes. Just remember, I'm going through the book, and I'm going to keep going through the book. When you're here, great. If you're not, I hope you're sober and I hope you're happy.